Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizoan Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
Well, good evening, all. Good to be here with you this evening, both in the Zendo, and I see we have some friendly faces online. So this evening, I want to talk a bit about maturing through this practice. The path I've chosen to talk about this topic is to compare two different modern views of maturity. One through a psychological viewpoint, and the other through a Buddhist monk standpoint. I think it should be instructive in comparison. So as we move through this life, we tend to exchange old stories for new ones, but always there is a backdrop of old fears, like a shadow that haunts us. In order to fully mature, we need to take these stories conscious, to see through them, identify and come to grips with our coping behaviors and strategies. Both Zen practice and psychotherapy help us to surface our perceived shortcomings and engage the process of transforming them. And in the process, we can commit to sharing our lives and relationships in a more ethical and appropriate way. We can choose to act according to our best instincts and ethics, while not accepting any authority without questioning. After all, as the Buddha taught, you are a light unto yourself. Maturity is consciously established over time. It is not granted. It is discovered in an earnest process of exploration. So tonight we'll take a look at two contemporary views of awakening, of maturing, viewed from both personal and societal angles. The Buddha in his time was compared to a physician. In the early discourses are some examples of his taking care of sick monks. In fact, religious figures of both East and West at that time were often found to play roles of philosophers, advisors, and healers who would recommend activities, medicinal herbs, and dietary supplements to treat the ailing. Some of them were brought into royal courts to attend to the ruling classes. It is only in the last few centuries, beginning with the so-called Age of Enlightenment in the West, that these healing practices developed into their own specialized and highly focused sciences. So tonight I'll present two apparently complementary views of the spiritual maturation process from two modern sages. The first from the Jungian psychologist James Hollis, and the second from secular Buddhist teacher, monk, and scholar Stephen Batchelor. We've all heard the classic quote attributed to Socrates that the unexamined life is not worth living. James Hollis' book, Living an Examined Life, explores the theme of growing up, maturing into human beings with a keen sense of inquiry and responsibility. He says the first half of our lives is mostly spent making our mistakes, and the latter half taking stock of lessons learned. He offers us a kick in the butt, a list of reminders and challenges for the mind that is wising up. His mentor, Carl Jung, said we seldom solve problems, but we can outgrow them. We have the choice to steer away from our tribally prescribed institutions, despite our insecurities, and that our doubts and fears should be rendered conscious, considered, and tested. We can deliberately choose to serve life by being true to ourselves, by taking responsibility for the projections and expectations we have developed as armor in an uncertain world. Growing up, with a capital G, means developing freedom from our conditionings. Our ancestors developed rites of passage to guide us through our life transformations, providing orientation and meaning, which are largely missing from modern life. So we need to feed ourselves with a modern mythic structure, one geared toward what he calls psycho-spiritual independence, rather than managing fear through compliance and avoidance. Or worse, operating through a false sense of certainty or simplistic justifications, and bowing to authorities that are happy to have your compliance and attention. At what price? Seeing this, we can choose to let go of the safety of the predictable, learned from our earliest experiences. Change inevitably produces anxiety, and the ability to tolerate change and ambiguity is the mark of what Hollis calls the moral measure of a culture. And our protests against change are registered through the body, in our dreams and interactive behaviors. When these sensations and experiences are made conscious, we ask the question, what is this? And we can begin to develop the courage to clean house, to recover our personal authority. We begin to ask, who are we aside from our history, roles, and commitments? Have we become estranged from our instinctual and deeply insightful true nature? We can begin by making amends, asking how injustice has been perpetrated in your life, and toward what groups and individuals. We are asked to discern the origins of our actions and ask, do they serve healing? Can we do what we are afraid of and face our anxieties squarely? Individuation means stepping out of the shade learned from our parents and the templates of external authority. We vow to get unstuck. The field of depth of psychology says first that it's not about what it's about. In other words, ritualized behaviors that serve as anxiety management systems, self-improvement routines of diet, exercise, etc., are often just a placebo in search for meaning. The second rule of depth psychology is that what you see is a compensation for what you don't see. Overwhelm and abandonment being the two extremes driving our stuckness. We need to take a risk, like a river joining the ocean. We are instructed to return to the task. We tend to take flight from suffering due to a lack of meaning. In the psychological view, the task of individuation is the removal of fear and removing obstacles to becoming who you really are. Real meaning is not defined by our culture. We must show up. This is our gift to the world. Hollis reminds us, we forget our task, our responsibility to our talents, to our interests, and to our unique perspectives on the world, because it is easier to do so. Instead, he encourages us to show up as best we can and take the path of enlargement. The path to personhood is a step into oneself, one's talents, interests, and callings, regardless of whether others approve or not. No patterns of the past can be used as excuses to stay small. And as they say, the way out is through. Not withholding your gifts, We can choose to expand our resilience regardless of the wounds we've suffered. We can offer the unique gift of ourselves with all our faults, shortcomings, mistakes, and fears. It's the only way to honestly engage with the world, offering the humble abode of ourselves, of our selfing, with no ifs, ands, or buts standing in the way. We can gradually come to see our old destructive patterns, our idiosyncratic maps of the world. Ask yourself, are you a hider, or a fixer, or an overachiever? We all look for acceptance and tend to stick to the known. But there is no going forward without a death of some kind. Hollis encourages us to deal with the hauntings of the past with courage and perseverance, even though some days the ghosts will win. Many of us rely on traditional religious institutions. Others seek the soothing of substances and distractions to deal with our modern anxieties. But if we can sense the bigger picture, we see the need for daily recalibration. An authentic journey asks us to embrace contradictions and encounter more mystery than might be comfortable. It means surrendering certainty for mystery, not knowing. We are more alive when we are serving life, and we can choose meaning over happiness. Happiness is transient, while meaning abides. In meaning, we are asked to trust something deeper, something unique to each of us. And in working through the difficulties we choose to face, we can know happiness and even joy. We can honor what we've left behind while we seize permission to be. The psychologist urges us to recognize the emotional basement that we have plumbed in early on, our shadow values. We must struggle to make as much of this as conscious as we can and take responsibility for it. We are reminded that a spiritual summons must be honored and that we deprive ourselves and others by not bringing out our more developed selves to share. Permission to do so must be seized, not shirked. This is how we begin a life of service for all beings. Can we exorcise the ghosts of living in the past? Hollis has this beautiful phrase, "We all live in haunted houses and sleep in memory's unmade bed." It is as if one is defined by a past sense of oneself, rather than a person who can learn from the past what works and what doesn't. The reality is that we have an ever-increasing ability to take on these challenges, and a resilience that few things can outlast. We are not defined by our history. It's time to turn on the lights and clean house. We must model and grant permission to our children and lift the burdens of our own unfinished lives from their shoulders. If we will put aside self-doubt and bring the discipline necessary to every day, we can show up in a larger way than feels comfortable. Finally, he reminds us that vocation is our duty to our calling. The task of individuation is about sacrificing the familiar. Don't fear to contribute our messy selves to the world. A mature spirituality shifts us away from the tribal religion to the shoulders of the individual. It is a privilege to confront the mystery of this precious human life. Find what resonates, open to what is not willed by the ego. Our practices should deepen our engagement and honor our ethics. Grow by giving yourself permission to be who you really are. Recognize the power of unconscious conditioning and the lack of permission to engage your life journey. Risk trusting inner authority and recognize your own inner wisdom. Live the questions, not the answers. What we most desire is meaning. Build a holding place where the old can be decommissioned and the needs of the emerging moment be attended. So let's now take a look at the process of maturation as presented from a secular Buddhist view from Stephen Batchelor's book, After Buddhism. He notes that in the past we relied on tribal certainties that assisted us in survival in an uncertain world. And to the extent that we still do, we remain in fear-driven modes. In our modern age, we have largely gone from believing in heaven, hell, and reincarnation to the understandings of science and psychology. Batchelor tells us that Dharma practice exposes the limits of human thought and language, where we are confronted with the puzzle of being here at all. Whether or not they acknowledge it, all people share this puzzle of unknowing, of great doubt. The Buddha taught that we must dwell in it to see the sublime in our everyday experience. To dwell in emptiness or constant change means to fully inhabit the embodied space of sensory experience, but not in a way that is determined by habit. It does not mean that one will no longer suffer. That will always be true for a creature made of flesh and blood. The Buddha envisioned a community in which all members, whatever their status or level of training, partake equally in the practices and in the responsibility of communicating. He was concerned with how the Dharma can enable humans and all beings to flourish, not in a supposed afterlife, but in the experience of being alive on this planet, not emphasizing personal liberation, but grounded in compassion for the suffering of all who share this earth. Instead of imagining a Dharma that builds barriers around an alienated self, one that instead works toward an enchantment of the world, one in which we are engaged with the everyday sublime. The Buddha expressed the attitude that it is fitting for us to be perplexed, to question, and warns us that we should not be enslaved by oral traditions, teaching lineage, hearsay, scriptures, logical reasoning or reflection, or by the acceptance of a view after considering it. Instead, we adopt an attitude of skepticism. It is a practical view that leads to changes in behavior that affect the quality of your life. Not theoretical, but based in loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. Not just cognitive or thought-based. Batchelor suggests that religious approaches tend to base their practice on beliefs, whereas secular ones tend to base their practice on questions. He says our practice should not be motivated by the intention to overcome craving, to eliminate suffering, but that experience should provide the motivation to respond authentically to the questions that life poses. Key to the Buddha's vision is the development of an understanding of conditionality. Excuse me. Conditionality provides the context for a fourfold task: to comprehend suffering, to let go of what's arising, to observe its ceasing, and to cultivate an eightfold path that is grounded in mindful awareness, which leads us to become self-reliant in the practice of the Dharma. The freedom that the Buddha speaks of is the freedom not to act on the impulses that naturally arise in reaction to events. We are offered a choice, a radically different way of being in this world. Ultimately, the middle way means we are free from both thoughtless indulgence and pleasure on the one hand, and the temptation of self-punishment on the other. Because anyone from any background could become a practitioner, the community that one entered upon committing oneself to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha potentially included the whole of humanity. Life's meaning becomes obscured beneath layers of familiar thoughts and habits of mind, and by the comforts and attachments of our everyday routines. Whereas life in the Dharma is rich in possibility. In one of the discourses, the ground of awakening is compared to a clearing in a dense forest, where the view suddenly opens up and admits the light. This opening allows a person to see more clearly and move more freely, allowing new possibilities of understanding and behavior to emerge. Batchelor says that the best way to know your past is to examine the quality of your present experience, and that the best way to prepare for the future is to consider the quality of what you think, say, and do in response to situations in the moment. Using reason to help others decide how to think, speak, and act, not by pursuing abstract arguments or theoretical truths. Nirvana is immediately present here and now, and where we choose to live our life. The Buddha's reasoning is practical and ethical. The ability to change how we think allows us to overcome Mara and her army. Her forces are the thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs, and stories that naturally arise in the minds of conscious creatures. Mara is the personification of reactivity. Like the Buddha, we choose not to feed these impulses. Letting go of reactivity, we do not try to avoid the world, but to move through it lightly. To release oneself from habits and instinctive behaviors requires developing a mature appreciation of mortality in each fragile moment. Much of what we take for granted about ourselves and the world is the result of being embedded in the specific culture, society, and language of when and where we were born. In the Buddha's time, the worldview of the culture of classical India had been accepted over generations, and the teaching of the laws of karma and rebirth were taken for granted in the development in the early years of Buddhist development. It was a necessary prerequisite of the time, much like the belief in God for any Christian or Muslim. What matters for the secular Buddhist is to live life in a way that results in a better world for those who will inhabit the earth after their death. The ideas of rebirth and karma fit the mythic language of the time and provided the rationale for the conditions that preceded their existence, and for the potentially infinite unfolding of the future. And in that way, they provided an inspiring view of life versus the smaller view of the ego's grasping. Our modern world provides an alternative with its finely detailed descriptions of the emergence of life, from limitless galactic expansion to the development of the simplest organisms, to the complexity of the human brain. The worldview of modern science provides the four tasks with a sound foundation, freed from Indian metaphysics and beyond the narrow context of Buddhist orthodoxy. Psychology and psychotherapy have enabled us to penetrate the history of our childhood and to arrive at insights into how our sense of self is formed. And by studying our reactions and choices, our sciences provide ample illustrations of conditioned arising made flesh. This vision is able to awaken and tune our moral sense and brings the Dharma down to earth. This modern reading treats rebirth as a metaphor for hell and a loop of repetitive existence, while karma locks us into cycles of reactive behavior and carelessness. The freedom of nirvana can be experienced as the direct result of understanding how reactivity works, not as the result of uprooting it. Reactivity will always be there, but we can choose. Mara is, therefore, any physical, social, political, or economic impediment to our practice of the four tasks. Our realization of potential as human beings rests in the hands of those who enjoy and value equality. A secular Sangha allows for the empowerment of those who are previously marginalized and disempowered. And community is an ongoing practice requiring commitment and action, where all are regarded as works in progress. So I have a few thoughts regarding these two overviews of maturation as earthly beings. I find there is a curious alignment between the Jungian individuation and Buddhist enlightenment, with the common thread of awakening to our authenticity. It's striking to me to see how closely the modern science of psychology has parallels to much of Buddhist thought and philosophy. Both are skeptical and provide a practical and ethical North Star for discovering our true nature and in seeking freedom from our pervasive conditioning. There are differences in terminology, but with seemingly similar definitions. One speaks of the task, while the other a fourfold task. One presents a path to personhood, while Buddhists describe an eightfold path. One claims the way out is through, while the other expounds the benefits of joyful effort. The psychologist values not withholding your gifts. The Buddhist offers the paramita of generosity. In fact, you have to wonder how much of modern psychology borrows from, is inspired by, or draws from the same well of wisdom as Buddha's Dharma. Both require discernment and the development of the moral qualities for facing your challenges. Vocation versus vow, engagement versus mindful attention. Is this just different vocabulary for the same qualities? Both stress ethical behavior and the development of inner wisdom. Both demand responding to the emerging moment. Both focus on questioning assumptions and habits and moving beyond them. So, what are the contrasts? I see that important physical elements of Buddhist practice, most prominently the various forms of meditation and ritual, are missing from purely psychological methods. The story of Buddha's touching the earth at the moment of triumph over Mara is a powerful symbol and testament to our physical presence, connection, and origins. And if the goal of Jungian individuation is one's ultimate self-expression, could that also lead to the alienation of an inflated self versus one grounded in compassion and in communication with the world? No doubt, Buddhists suffer the same risk, where confidence in one's authority can overwhelm humility. And does the pursuit of individuation allow for communal growth as a focus of mutual support, as the Sangha presumably does for the Buddhist? For both, it appears, living the questions is most intimate.